Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President-elect Barack Obama says it straight up. He's been reading Lincoln. And Doris Kearns Goodwin on Lincoln and his famous team of rivals. He could read the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian on nearly all the presidential precedents getting buzz in Washington these days. Lincoln, FDR, JFK, LBJ, on depression, war, White House teams, and getting things done. She's written the books. This hour on Point, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin on the past and Obama. You can join the conversation. What do you hope the president-elect is learning as he looks back to look ahead? What should Obama learn from those who came before? Here's Barack Obama last month on 60 Minutes with Steve Croft.
I've been spending a lot of time reading Lincoln. There's a wisdom there and a humility about his approach to government, even before he was president, that I just find very helpful.
Put a lot of his political enemies in his cabinet.
He did.
Is that something you're considering?
Well, I tell you what, I find him a very wise man.
Did somebody say, Lincoln, you can't get away from him lately? This week in Chicago, U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald here detailing the charges against Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich.
The most cynical behavior in all this, the most appalling, is the fact that Governor Blagojevich tried to sell the appointment to the Senate seat vacated by President-elect Obama. The conduct would make Lincoln roll over in his grave.
Roll over in his grave. It makes us want to learn what Doris Kearns Goodwin has to say. She joins us now from New York. Doris Kearns Goodwin worked as a White House aide to Lyndon B. Johnson, published her widely acclaimed first book, Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream, in 1976, and has been one of the country's most read presidential historians ever since. She wrote The Fitzgeralds and the Kennedys, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1995 for No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, the Homefront in World War II. Her 2005 book, Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, was a New York Times number one bestseller when it was first published, and now, since Barack Obama began assembling his cabinet, has soared back up the charts. Number four on the New York Times bestseller list today, 3 years after it came out. Doris Kearns Goodwin, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, you're welcome, Tom. What fun to be able to talk about history with a president thinking about history.
No kidding. And a great time for a historian to be alive. How do you think all the presidents that you've paid so much attention to would look at what Barack Obama's up to in assembling this cabinet right now? Would they recognize the process, the dynamics, what he's in the midst of, Doris?
Well, certainly Abraham Lincoln would. I mean, what Lincoln understood when he became president was that he was not as experienced as his main rivals were. And as he said, the country was in peril. These are the strongest and most able men in the country. I need them by my side. And I think that's what Mr. Obama has done as well, is to recognize that we have so many things to deal with now between the financial crisis at home and the wars abroad, that he doesn't want to allow personal feelings or any kind of past problems in terms of rivalrous relationships to prevent him from putting the people he wants to be in his cabinet. And I think it's a great thing because it means that you have people around you who are going to question you, argue with you. You get they're free from feeling that there'll be consequences if they disagree with you. It gives you more options when you finally get to make your decision.
We're going to march right through the presidents you know so well and see what lessons we can find for Barack Obama here. But I guess, first of all, does the cabinet, as it's coming together so far, and we've got new names even today, a Nobel Prize winner, a Secretary of Energy, but does it qualify as a team of rivals? He's got, of course, Hillary Clinton there and his former rivals in the primary, Joe Biden at his side as vice president, Bill Richardson at Commerce, Bill Gates, George Bush's defense secretary. By the standards of Lincoln's team of rivals, is this a real team of rivals?
Well, I think so, because I think, as I say, what it meant for Lincoln was not simply the fact that he put these three people who'd been against him in the nomination into his cabinet. He brought in former Democrats, former Whigs. He assembled a team of strong-minded people, which meant they would be arguing, which meant there'd be fiery kinds of conflicts within the cabinet. And it's been said of Obama's choices as well. There's a lot of smart people there, a lot of people with a lot of ego, and that could produce problems, but I think it's all to the good. So, yes, I think it does. Hopefully they don't remain rivals when they get in there. They become part of a team. That's the whole challenge that Obama will have to face.
And I've got to ask you right off the bat about Rod Blagojevich, governor of Abraham Lincoln's home state and mine, Illinois, hanging its head in shame these days. You heard the prosecutor Fitzgerald right there saying Lincoln would roll over in his grave. I mean, let's step away from Obama for just a second, though it's not so far away because it's his Senate seat that the governor was apparently, allegedly trying to sell. How does it stack up as chicanery in national terms, Illinois terms? How do you look at the latest news out of Chicago, Doris?
I mean, it's actually one of the worst, I think. And I think the reason is that it's so simple to understand what a terrible thing he was doing. So many other times, corruption, it's not clear what's going on. There's graft, there's payoffs. But here you have a direct idea that you can buy a Senate seat for a certain amount of money. And think about it. The reason we passed the 13th Amendment for the direct election of the senators way back in 1913 was that before that, the Senate really was a millionaire's club. The state legislatures would choose the senators, and they often were subject to payment for it. Some senator from Rhode Island was called the railroad senator. Somebody else was the oil senator. So we knew what a corrupt system it was, and we changed it by the direct election. And now you still have this little wrinkle that in this period of time when you have a special choice to be made because there's a vacancy, then they're subject to this kind of corruption. It's a terrible thing.
Did Lincoln himself, he who, you know, is cited as rolling over in his grave, have a lot to say about corruption? Was it a big issue in the years of his administration or the run-up?
You know, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure I've fully thought about it. I mean, I think before the Industrial Revolution, before big business had so many dealings with government, there probably was less kinds of projects that you could be corrupt on. There were what they called internal improvements, which were waterways and harbors being dredged. But it's really the late 19th century, 20th century involvement of business and government and money and campaign finances that have brought the corruption to a much bigger level now than they would have been in the mid-19th century.
Doris, I want to keep the phones wide open to people with questions on history and Obama and presidents past for you today. Let's get a call from New Haven, Connecticut. And Tom, you're on the air with Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I think the most important and apparent thing about what Obama's team of rivals is right now is that he has so many strong personalities, so many strong and talented people around him that it really means that he's going to govern this country as a pragmatist, a no-nonsense, get-it-done, we might differ in opinion, but this is what we need to do, so just get-it-done kind of a president.
A pragmatism as opposed to what, Tom? As opposed to ideology?
Exactly. I mean, obviously Barack Obama has his world view, but we've seen, especially in the last 8 years, that ideologues just surround themselves with yes-men, and a lot of the time there's just a lot of fluff that's get thrown out there. With all these strong and talented people around him, this, I guess, new team of rivals, he's really going to just have to be, just do your job, get it done. This is what we need to do. We need to fix the economy. So how are we going to do it?
Tom, thanks very much. Doris, how about it? Pragmatism as the guiding light of a team of rivals here, does that work as a rallying cry?
I mean, I think what he's saying is really interesting because I think what happens is by surrounding yourself with a lot of people who are going to have different points of view, it doesn't mean you may not carry through a progressive agenda, but it means that you're going to listen to the other side so that when you make your decisions, you have incorporated it into your thinking. For example, when Lincoln finally made the decision about the Emancipation Proclamation, he had listened for months to people who had very differing points of view in his cabinet. Some said, don't touch it. Others said, do it right away. He makes his decision. He goes to them. He says, now the time for debate is over. I've made my decision, but I will listen to your suggestions. on its implementation and its timing. So by having these strong people there, he's not going to get caught, as I think the caller suggested, in people who just agree with him. Even if he were to make the same decision, he wouldn't have understood the other sides. And the more people around you that tell you different things, as long as you can come to make the decision, you're in better shape.
But what about this? I mean, the characterization is out there, very high and prominent, strong cabinet, smart cabinet, no bones about it. Frank Rich was writing Sunday in the New York Times, though, referring to you and to David Halberstam, saying when Halberstam came out with the 20th anniversary edition of his big book, The Best and the Brightest, he expressed concern that people had lost track of what he really meant by that title, that the best and the brightest had run America off the rails out of the JFK and into the LBJ years. I mean, if it's best and brightest, if it's strong and smart, is that sufficient? How do you look at it?
Well, I think what Halberstam meant was that inside that cabinet, you need people with practical political experience. I think somebody was at Tip O'Neill who said, I wish one of them had run for sheriff. There were
right.
a lot of academics, right? Mm-hmm. But here, when you look at who's being assembled inside the cabinet, I mean, obviously, Tom Daschle has a lot of political experience. Rahm Emanuel has a lot of political experience. And one hopes that when the full cabinet gets together, you've got the governor of Arizona. So he's not just choosing smart academics to surround himself, which was, I think, what Halberstam was concerned about. He's choosing a range of people who come from different fields, and then you will get that practical experience melded with the thoughtfulness, hopefully, that comes from smart people.
Tom Daschle.
Hopefully you can have smart and political at the same time.
And wise. It would sure be great. Tom Daschle expected, I guess, to be formally announced maybe tomorrow as Secretary of Health and Human Services. Doris Kearns Goodwin, we're so glad to have you today, and we've got lots of questions coming in here to put to you. We want to look at FDR, at JFK, at LBJ, all these presidential precedents, and Obama coming up. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, author of Team of Rivals, about Lincoln, FDR, JFK, LBJ, and Obama. Doris Kearns Goodwin joins us today from New York. Let's listen back just a little bit here to March 4th, 1933. Here's Franklin Delano Roosevelt asserting optimism in his first inaugural address, saying the country would again prosper despite those tough times.
This is preeminently the time to speak the truth, the whole truth, frankly and boldly. Nor need we shrink from honestly facing conditions in our country today. This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
FDR at his first inauguration, March 4th, 1933. Let's get a call from Martin in Fairfax, South Carolina. Martin, you're on the air with Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Ms. Goodwin.
Hello.
I really admire your work. One thing, Tom, that I'm not understanding as we approach the inauguration of President-elect Obama is we keep hearing about how these times are as tough as they were at the time that FDR took over in the Great Depression. And it seems like everyone forgets about just how hard it was when Ronald Reagan took over in 1981. I mean, we were facing a Cold War with the Soviet Union, communist expansion through guerrilla proxies in Central America. Afghanistan had been invaded. The misery index now is 10.16%. The misery index when Ronald Reagan took office was 21.68%. And, you know, regarding the cabinet choices, I think what Mr. Obama is doing is taking on a beehive that he's going to regret. Mr. Reagan brought in a troika of Howard Baker, Ed Meese, and Mike Deaver. They advised him well, and we got through those times. Inflation was brought down, unemployment was brought down, and we triumphed over the Soviet Union.
Martin, we've got it loud and clear. Doris, what do you think? It's a funny business comparing sad sack stories or tales of woe. On the other hand, you know, there are tough times in the 30s, there were a lot of problems at the end of the 70s, and here comes Obama. How do you compare the circumstances these three presidents walked into?
Well, I think the one thing you can say is that just listening to the FDR inaugural and remembering Ronald Reagan's confidence and optimism, and hopefully the same thing to be coming from Obama, what a leader needs in these tough times is somehow to walk that fine line between not seeming too optimistic, really facing the fact that things are tough, just as FDR did in that inaugural, just in a certain sense as Obama did on the night of his victory when he said he knew there would be failures. Mm. He knew that the path was steep. The road would be the path was steep. Mm-hmm. The road was climbed.
Right.
But just as FDR had said in this famous war speech he made in 1942, where he said, we're going to lose battles before we win. But then he reminded us of Washington at Valley Forge when they ran out of supplies, and then they persevered and the war was won, the early days of the Civil War. So I think when a president can look back, as he hopefully is doing, not only to Lincoln but to FDR, perhaps to Reagan as well, to see what was the tenor of leadership to walk that line, to make you know, yes, these are difficult times, but countries have come through this before. America has come through it before. We will do it again. You know, when Roosevelt made that first inaugural address, there was a wonderful letter that came into the White House saying, my dog just died, my wife is mad at me, my roof fell off, I've lost my job, but now everything's okay because you're in the White House, which is crazy, but it just shows that mystical kind of leadership that can connect a country that's nervous with a president who has confidence.
Inspiration key, but how do you compare the circumstances Obama's walking into? I mean, FDR's one of your areas, especially Reagan, not so much. But when you look out at what Barack Obama is now looking out at, how do you compare it to what FDR saw? And what about Martin's point? Reagan had his hands full also.
Well, I think in terms of FDR, surely the Depression was in much deeper fashion than it is today. I mean, you had a quarter, sometimes 30% of the people out of work. You didn't have the safety nets that we have now today, no unemployment insurance, no food stamps, no home mortgage preparations the way we have somewhat in state today, so that it was a much more difficult situation. People in bread lines, people really losing faith in the system as a whole, and you had that fear maybe of socialism or communism taking over in other parts of the world that might even come here. And I think that fear is lessened today. But there is obviously that sense of catapulting things getting worse, more and more people losing jobs, and the trickle-down effect. And you sometimes wonder, my God, is that what they felt like in 1930 when they kept thinking, it's going to get better? It took so long for it to get better. That's the sobering memory of the 1930s.
Let's listen to just a little more of that. Here again, FDR, from that inauguration, ticking off America's depression woes as he came into office.
Values have shrunk to fantastic levels. Taxes have risen. Our ability to pay has fallen. Government of all kinds is faced by serious curtailment of income. The means of exchange are frozen in the currents of trade. The withered leaves of industrial enterprise lie on every side. Farmers find no markets for their produce. And the savings of many years in thousands of families are gone.
Putting it right in the ear of the country there in 1933, FDR. Jimmy Carter, of course, at the end of the 70s, talked about malaise. And if there was one, I guess Ronald Reagan inherited it. What about that hinge, that point in history, Doris?
Well, you know, it's interesting just listening again to one thing that FDR said when he said taxes have risen. He was very worried about a balanced budget when he came in 1932. And in fact, he promised on the campaign trail that he would balance the budget. And then, of course, he had to unbalance it in order to do the public works projects and all the things that he was going to do to help people survive. So in 1936, when he was running again, the Republicans rightly got on him. What about that promise you made in Pittsburgh to balance the budget? So he called his speechwriters in and he said, what are we going to do about that promise? They said, well, we'll think about it and we'll come back to you. They come back in a few days and they say, Mr. President, the only thing for you to do is to say you never set foot in Pittsburgh in your entire life. There's no answer. But he obviously, interestingly, he was so concerned about the balanced budget that in 1937-38, when it was beginning to get better, the economy, he undid some of these programs, thinking that the entrepreneurial system was ready to take over. We fell back down into a recession again. Only did the war production really get us out of the Depression finally.
When you look at the team that Obama is assembling, Larry Summers, of course, back from the Clinton years there on the economic front, Timothy Geithner out of the New York Fed, and on down the list, do you see an FDR-style New Deal approach being assembled in the personalities and perspectives around this next president?
Well, certainly several of them have already talked prior to being selected for the cabinet positions of the need for a major stimulus. And that is something that FDR did. In that inaugural address, again, he said, we need action, and we need action now. And he put people to work. That was his first goal. And it does seem like there's a consensus within this new team that Obama has assembled, as well as Obama himself, as well as the Congress, that we do need a stimulus. The question will be, what is the size of it? And I think the key to be learned from the New Deal is what's important is to put it, if you can, in projects that have a long-term benefit, that are not simply going to be taking people off the streets, but then not doing anything with them. And that's where the energy part comes in. Maybe you have green jobs. Maybe you're building the infrastructure, things that would be good to be done even without the recession. But when you have to get things done quickly, that's going to be the challenge, I guess, because some of those might take longer to be planned.
Let's go to Austin, Texas, and John. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah. First, I'd just like to say that I love Doris Kearns Goodwin's comments, and I'm very happy to get them whenever they're available.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome. I'm thrilled to have a president who's so openly looking to history for answers. I wondered what kind of grade you would give the outgoing administration in terms of their willingness to look to history for answers.
Well, you know, the one moment when I so wish that President Bush had looked to history would have been right after September 11th, because there the country was ready to do whatever he asked us to do, to work together collectively to deal with the terrorist threat, just as Roosevelt, after Pearl Harbor, understood that then he had to become a bipartisan president. He brought in two top Republicans into his cabinet, Stimson and Knox. He reached out to business. He asked people to have war bonds so they could contribute. He asked people to sacrifice with rationing. He made people feel they were part of a civilian defense corps in the cities, and hundreds of people went to work. Thousands of people went to work in the factories, three shifts a day, to be able to get the ships, tanks, and weapons we needed. We couldn't even get unarmored Humvees armored in Iraq because we didn't have that sense of a national enterprise. Our soldiers were fighting the war, and if only he'd look back to that moment. He had his moment, and I feel so sad that that didn't happen.
Right there, looking at that president, this president-elect, as a red team of rivals, actually called you about it after he read it. What's your sense of how Obama's looking back at Honest Abe?
Well, you know, the wonderful thing to have a president who looks back at history is that what it means is that they are bigger, their dimension is greater, because they really can learn from the past. And I think it's not simply the fact that Lincoln put in place this team of rivals, but there's so many qualities to Lincoln's temperamental style that I believe Mr. Obama is going to be able to learn from. I mean, even working on him, as I did for 10 years, waking up with him in the morning, sleeping with him at night in my mind, I felt like I had learned from his willingness to acknowledge errors when you make them, his willingness to share credit for success, to shoulder the blame for the failure of his subordinates, to connect to the people emotionally in the country. I mean, there's so many ways in which he understood his own weaknesses, so he was able to compensate for them. He had his flaws, which Obama can learn from as well. He could not fire people easily, which was the same flaw that FDR had. Eleanor once said it came out of FDR's strength that he liked people, he didn't want to hurt them. He should have fired McClellan much earlier than he did, and hopefully Obama can learn from that lesson that sometimes, as nice as you might be with people, you got to let them go. So there's so much you can learn. It gives you a whole range, not only from FDR and Lincoln, but as you said, from LBJ. If you can learn from these people, you're not starting all over again, which is what makes it great to care about history.
The Civil War historian Matthew Pinsker has come out in recent weeks and said, well, this team of rivals, it had some big problems, too, before that first term was over. You know, three out of four had resigned, one in disgrace, one in defiance, one in disgust, and Lincoln was riding a pretty wild crew there. Is there a meltdown scenario that worries you in a team of rivals cabinet?
Well, I think the question would be, for example, you had two people in that team that are very interesting, Seward and Chase. Seward is almost like the Hillary at the start. He was the senator from New York. Everybody thought he would be the nominee.
World famous.
World famous, exactly. Mm-hmm. So sure he was going to win that he went waltzing off to Europe for 9 months prior to the convention. Mm. He was so confident. He comes in, and everybody thought he will be the guy in charge. Lincoln puts him in his place, and they become great friends. He understands that Lincoln is unlike anyone he ever met. However, Chase, who becomes the Secretary of the Treasury, never did give up his desire to be president and tried to run against Lincoln from within the cabinet, and that is the cautionary note. The only difference today from 1864 is then one-term presidencies were the rule, so it wasn't that weird to try and run against your guy. Mm-hmm. Today, two-term presidencies are the rule. It's very hard to run against. I can't picture any one of these guys really mounting a challenge unless something really goes wrong in the Obama administration, and then that'll be much more difficult for him to deal with than somebody trying to challenge him from the outside or inside.
Though we all know how hard it is to put down presidential ambitions once they're picked up. Let's get a call from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Tim. Tim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Real pleasure to be on the show. Really enjoyed the conversation, and I had a question for you. Well, I've been talking a lot with my friends about the rise of Hillary Clinton and what's this going to mean, and the argument I keep hearing is, well, Hillary Clinton's just a celebrity. She doesn't know anything about the affairs of state. And it seems to me like when she was running for president, she used her gravity to gather a lot of qualified people. So when Obama bought Hillary Clinton, he was really buying all the people around her. And I'm kind of curious, historically, when Lincoln made his team of rivals, did you get a lot of people along with those rivals, or was there not as much of an entourage? Did you just get the man when you picked them? And I can take my comments off the air.
Very interesting question. Doris?
It's amazing the contrast between then and now, and this questioner brings it up so brilliantly. There were so few people involved in the government then. I mean, on Lincoln's White House staff, for example, he had two secretaries, young guys, Nicolay and Hay. Can you imagine the difference between that and
there
today,
they are,
right?
Over in that corner.
And even the State Department where Seward was running, I forget, there's maybe like 60 people there. I mean, the contrast between the numbers now and then is so enormous that it makes it seem like it's a different planet that we were living in. Yes, there were some good people that would be brought in who had known and been friendly with both Chase and Seward, for example, before they came in. But you're talking, you know, a handful rather than hundreds as it would be today.
And apart from the pure numbers, what about the entourage aspect here? I mean, it seems to have come out in reports that, you know, this is something people now demand or ask, that Hillary Clinton may have negotiated. Well, yes, I'll come, but I want to be able to bring XYZ, you know, QRST in with me.
No, I mean, really, it's the White House and the cabinet offices have grown so exponentially, and the people who are in office feel like they are, you know, of a different sort than everybody else in a way that wasn't true really until after probably World War II. I mean, even during Roosevelt's time, the White House staff were considered anonymous. You didn't really know them in the way now they are celebrities. And so, too, are the people who will be working for the cabinet officers. They become celebrities because of the media, now because of cable news, even more so, which brings its own problems, I think, because you could have arguments within the Lincoln administration, but we knew about them from the diaries and the letters years later. Now, can you imagine if one cabinet member called another a traitor and the other one wouldn't go into the room where the other one was, which is what happened in Lincoln's time, we would know about it on the cable news at night. So
know about it.
We
would be brined and bathed in it for days.
Exactly. So it does mean that it's a riskier enterprise, but I think Obama feels it's worth it in order to have the best advice he can possibly have, and he trusts his own ability to make the decisions the way he wants to and then bring the team along.
He's been pretty cool on the path to the White House, but it gets bumpier once you're actually in there and responsible every day.
Oh, nothing prepares you for it, I think. You know, it's interesting. FDR said to his son on the night he was elected in 1932 that all of his life he'd only been afraid of one thing, and that was fire, in part because he had seen his aunt when he was a little boy burn herself accidentally and fall down the stairs and die. And then as a paraplegic, he was terrified of fire because he was afraid he'd be stuck somewhere. But he said to his son, but now I have another fear. Will I have the strength to see the country through this crisis? So I think once you could feel it even the night when Obama was elected, there was a soberness to his demeanor. He didn't come out saying, yay, here I am. He's aware of what he's going through, but you'll be even more aware from it. Lincoln said that if he'd ever known how hard it was to live between his election and Fort Sumter, he wasn't sure he could have lived through it if he had known that ahead of time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, author of Team of Rivals, about Lincoln, FDR, LBJ, and Obama. Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, came out in 2005, back on the bestseller lists now as people look at the cabinet that Barack Obama is putting together. Her first big presidential history was in 1976, Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream. She had worked for and with Lyndon Johnson. Here's LBJ from his inaugural address, January 20th, 1965.
The next man to stand here will look out on a scene that is different from our own, because ours is a time of change, rapid and fantastic change, bearing the secrets of nature, multiplying the nations, placing in uncertain hands new weapons for mastery and destruction, shaking old values and uprooting old ways.
There's another one-of-a-kind, LBJ, in 1965 at his inauguration. Let's go to Julia in Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Julia, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. and Ms. Goodwin, and thank you for making history so readable. I have a question about, actually, Franklin and Eleanor and also the Lincoln book. Eleanor was basically the eyes and ears for constituencies that FDR thought might be difficult or troublesome politically to deal with and acknowledge. And Mary Todd Lincoln had a totally different kind of role for Lincoln. I'm wondering if you could speak to the role that you might foresee for Michelle Obama in the White House with in regard to helping Mr. Obama.
Now, it's a very interesting question because it obviously depends so much on the dynamics of the marriage. When I first started doing the Lincoln book, I thought I would do what I did with Franklin and Eleanor to make it about Mary Todd and Abe. But then I realized that Mary couldn't carry the public side of the story the same way. Eleanor was so unusual. I'm not sure there'll easily be another Eleanor who really was the spur to her husband and did, as you say, travel the country on his behalf, bringing him back understandings and information from all sorts of people, blacks and minors and poor people, that he wouldn't have necessarily got inside the White House. From what we've heard from Michelle Obama, it seems to me that she's going to figure it out as she gets in there. She's got a major responsibility of those two young kids, which Mary Todd did as well, but which in certain sense, obviously, Eleanor did not have. And that changes things because it centers you in the White House. But it may mean that she'll work on work-family balance issues, as she said she would. I think she'll find out when she gets in there that it's an incredible platform. As Mrs. Bush found out, Laura Bush became a much more effective, much more outgoing first lady than anybody thought she would 8 years ago. And my guess is, given the articulateness and the already understandings that Michelle has had about politics and power, that she will work her way into figuring it out. But it probably will take time to determine which project she wants to give her major focus to.
Let me ask you about another major figure in the campaign season, John McCain. Barack Obama today naming Nobel Prize-winning physicist Stephen Chu as Secretary of Energy. You had suggested some weeks back that he might think about reaching out and tapping John McCain himself as Energy Secretary. That hasn't happened. What role do you imagine? You look at history, you look at John McCain, you look at Barack Obama. Is there a puzzle piece, big or small, that McCain plays that's close to Barack Obama, or is he an adversary?
Well, one would hope that if Barack Obama and McCain are able to establish a relationship, that McCain could well be the point person on the Hill to help bring Republicans to the issues that they both agree on. Climate change might be perhaps one of those, immigration reform another one. Just as LBJ had a friendship with Everett Dirksen, the minority Republican leader, which was absolutely critical to get the Republicans that he needed to help support the ending of the filibuster to create that great civil rights bill in 1964. You know, he goes to Dirksen and he says, "Now, Dirksen, you come with me on this bill. 99 years from now, the NAACP will be flying your banner." And then finally he says, "Dirksen, if you bring these Republicans on this bill, 200 years from now, school children will know only two names, Everett Dirksen and Abraham Lincoln." How could Dirksen resist? So Johnson understood that you had to use everybody that you could, create them to be part of the team. He said you had to court the Congress like you would court your wife. Mm. He would call them at 6 in the morning. He'd call them at midnight. One senator he called at 2 a.m. and he said, I hope I didn't wake you up. Right. And the senator said, oh, no, I was just lying here hoping my president would call. So if Obama is able to find those people in the Congress who can really be part of his team to get things through, and if McCain goes back to the McCain that he was before he ran, which was a much more centrist figure and much more bipartisan figure, it would be a fabulous team, I think, to have him aboard.
What about the kind of animal spirits question when it comes to Obama? We've been talking about LBJ, but Obama's got more of the kind of JFK cool. LBJ famously had the sort of bear hug, arm twisting, you know, in your face, and more than that. Do both work? Does the cool, you know, how do you look back? You've written about, thought about both presidents, looking at the challenges he's got now. Can he be cool? Does he have to rev up his LBJ, you know, arm lock?
It's an interesting thought because, you know, JFK wasn't comfortable, like, draping his arms over congressmen. I think, however, what you're going to have to do, even if you're not as physically in your face as LBJ was, I mean, JFK had that cool, you're right, is to bring them to the White House. I mean, the brilliance of LBJ was he'd have them over to the White House. He'd talk to them in small groups. He'd talk to them individually. And you may not have to do it in quite the kind of, you know, flamboyant fashion that LBJ did, but you have to do it. I mean, one of the things that I remember Tip O'Neill said about Reagan, going back to Reagan, was that he saw Reagan more in his first 4 years than he'd seen Carter the entire time. He saw Reagan, I'm sorry, more in his first year, because Reagan made a relationship with Tip O'Neill. Carter had not done that with his own Democratic majority leader. So you're going to have to reach out to them. Those guys need to be feeling like they're wanted.
Whether it's cool or physical, you better make sure they feel it. Let's go to Hinesburg, Vermont, and Ken. Ken, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to let, great program, by the way, I just want to let Doris know that she helped me become an early Obama supporter because when I read Team of Rivals a few years ago and then heard that Obama had read it and heard him speaking highly of Lincoln's methodology of forming his cabinet and governing.
It all clicked for you.
I got on board.
Okay.
So thanks for that. Now I'm just hoping that he's also read a book by Tim Weiner called Legacy of Ashes before he makes his appointment to head the CIA. That's my next hope. But I did want to thank Doris for that.
Ken, thanks very much. Doris, yes, the intelligence post, the head of the CIA, and more intelligence names yet to come and appear to have been more difficult for Obama. Your thoughts there?
Yeah, well, one hopes that, you know, it's not only the person he's going to put into place, but there has to be some understanding of the intelligence failures that proved so devastating for us in this time. Obviously, there were intelligence failures at the Bay of Pigs. Mm-hmm. There were intelligence failures before Pearl Harbor. There's also some wonderful people that have worked over time to get some great intelligence successes. But something didn't work right in these last years, and there must be a morale difficulty that's in the CIA now. I don't really know it firsthand, but one would guess. So you're going to have a leader that's able to buoy that morale and get back to the place where we're going to feel pride in our intelligence apparatus once again.
Let's get a call from Quebec and Walter. Hi, Walter. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. So my question has to do with the Team of Rivals. In Lincoln's case, this diverse Team of Rivals was unanimous on the great moral issue of the time involving the containment of slavery. On today's great issues, dominance of militarism in the United States and the network of far-flung bases all around the world was backed up with an aggressive foreign policy, the only consensus seems to be in favor of the status quo. I'll ask you to comment on that.
That's wonderful, Walter. It takes us back right to the very first question, in a way, Doris, on pragmatism versus ideology and perspective. Walter sees that consensus in Lincoln's time around slavery and wonders if there is a consensus on great moral issues now.
Well, even though there was, and he's absolutely right, a consensus on the need to contain slavery, there was not a consensus at first on how you would do that. I mean, you knew you couldn't let it go into the Western territories where it would be expanding, which was what the foundation of the Republican Party was. But within that cabinet, people felt very differently about whether you had the constitutional power or the right or the practical reality of trying to emancipate the slaves. So that's where having that discussion go on for months, as it did, until he finally made his decision, really helped him to figure out the timing of it. I think what you do see emerging is a consensus within the new Obama team for a more diplomatic approach abroad. It doesn't mean there won't be military presence, as was said. It doesn't mean that there's going to be disagreements about how long you keep troops where. But the idea that somehow you're going to try and create a new image for America abroad as one that's more willing to talk and negotiate, certainly that's what Obama has talked about. And I should think he'll have to make that a central tenet of his team, or else it could explode in the middle. But I suspect that that's something he's got to impress upon them, that that's your first response, even though you're dealing with the military whenever you have to as well. And you have to be strong, like Kennedy said, never fear to negotiate, but never negotiate out of fear.
There's another dynamic related, maybe even larger, that I wanted to ask you about, and that is Obama's expressed desire to change American politics, reshape, fundamentally, though it's a bit vague what exactly it means, but to fundamentally reshape the way we do politics, make policy, sort of think about governing the country. And when you look at it historically, I wonder what you make of that kind of language. Is that just campaign language? Does that really happen? And if you've seen it happen in particular administrations, eras, what are the requirements for a real change, a reshaping of politics?
I think we have seen it happen several times in the course of the last 150 years. Obviously, in the progressive era, what you had happening was that people in all walks of life became active in fighting for changing the way politics dealt with the tenements, the way we dealt with these huge oil industries that were coming up, the way we dealt with the big corporations, the robber barons. And they were journalists, muckrakers who cared about it, people in churches cared about it, people in the universities cared about it. And it gave Teddy Roosevelt in power, from the bottom up, pressure to put on the conservative Congress to pass the laws that began to be reining in some of these business enterprises. Mm. Again, in the 60s, you saw the civil rights movement combining with a lot of young people getting active in politics, bringing a pressure from below onto the Congress to pass all sorts of laws. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what Obama's been talking about. When he looks at history, the anti-slavery movement in the 1850s was essential to creating the climate that brought about the end of slavery, even though the war intervened in the middle of it all. So I think what he's saying is that when you see real change in the country, it's those moments when the activism of the citizenry pushes in so that the special interests in Washington don't have the same say they would if there's a lot of pressure from the country as a whole.
Let's go to Michelle in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Michelle, you're on the air with Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Hi. I've just finished reading Philip Roth's Plot Against America. I won't recap the novel here because it would take too much time, but I was struck by the way that Roosevelt in that book is portrayed and was perceived, I think, as such a almost a savior and a hero, someone who kind of rode in and saved America. And it reminded me very much of how many of us felt about Obama as we worked for him and voted for him. And it seems to me that the drawback to that is the inevitable letdown once reality sets in and he becomes president.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if that's not... I'd love to hear what Ms. Goodwin has to say about it. I'd also just like to say, in my opinion, I hope he follows in FDR's footsteps, which he seems to be doing, and spends what needs to be spent on what they like to call blithely Main Street, given how much we've already spent on Wall Street. Mm. So I'd like to hear what she has to say about that.
Great. Doris, the transition to the nitty-gritty.
I mean, it's true that I think when great expectations are there, if things begin to go wrong, then the disappointment can be even greater. But the opposite side of that is that along with the great expectations, both for FDR and Obama, was this crisis situation in his time and ours. And crisis affords a chance for more things to happen. I mean, sadly, it allows a collective response. People are more willing to put aside smaller agendas because of the need to work together. It's one of the reasons why I remember my husband worked in the Kennedy administration, mm-hmm. and he remembers one night having this discussion with Kennedy. Can you be a great president without a war? Can you really produce a lot of change unless you've got that huge situation facing you. Lincoln worried when he was a young man, would he ever have a chance for his generation to do anything great, because the founding fathers had already created everything, our country and our rivers and our streams and our democracy. And of course, he got his sad wish by having the anti-slavery movement lead to the Civil War, creating a crisis that allowed him to become great. So it does mean that there's a greater opportunity to pull the country together because of the difficulties we're facing, but it also means it's a much harder task. So hopefully he combines what Lincoln had, which was confidence and humility at the same time. That's what produces wisdom, I think, is the combination of those two.
Confidence plus humility. Who wouldn't vote for that? Michelle, thanks very much for your call. Doris, if you had his ear, you may have his ear. I mean, he's got, we're almost coming up on a month and a few days here to inauguration. What would you be pointing Barack Obama to look at in history from the presidents you know so well as he prepares to head into the Oval Office?
Well, I think the main thing to do would be to hope that there's various presidents that are going to help you at any particular moment in time. And that if you have people around you or you yourself that are reading history, I mean, Lincoln went back to read it when he was in office. FDR did. When FDR was trying to figure out what to do at a certain point, he went back and looked at Lincoln. When Teddy Roosevelt was trying to figure out what he was going to do about labor management strike, when Truman was trying to figure out what to do about firing MacArthur, he went back to Lincoln and McClellan. So I think just to know that if you can have people around you who can bring up the historical examples and the lessons that can be learned. The Bay of Pigs is a failure. You restructure your White House to create the Cuban Missile Crisis success, which JFK did, and allow history to be live around you. Then it does give you a dimension you would not. You're not starting from the beginning. You've really got the past to help you. And, of course, those of us who love history, that's what we want to believe.
Well, you certainly keep it live around us every time we talk, and we're very grateful for that. Doris Kearns Goodwin, Pulitzer Prize-winning presidential historian, author of Team of Rivals, No Ordinary Time, and many more. Thanks so much for your time and thoughts today.
Oh, you're welcome, Tom. I so enjoyed it.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gale Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby, with help from Carrie Schutpeltz and Michelle Tran. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.